From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we meet comedian Colin Quinn. He has his own late-night show on Comedy Central called Tough Crowd, in which he and four comics talk about the day's news. It's a natural extension of Quinn's earlier work at the anchor desk of Weekend Update on Saturday Night Live. Also, film critic David Edelstein reviews Manito, a low-budget film that's being distributed in a new way in an effort to make the movie accessible to more people. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Police arrested the Roman Catholic Bishop of Phoenix, Arizona today for involvement in a fatal hit-and-run crash. Bishop Thomas O'Brien was taken in after police traced a license plate number to his car and found that the windshield was broken in. Part of the license plate number was provided by witnesses who saw two cars hit a 43-year-old man as he crossed a street in the middle of the block on Saturday night. Neither car stopped. Earlier this month, O'Brien signed an agreement with prosecutors admitting that he allowed priests accused of sexual misconduct to continue working with minors. In return for giving up some of his authority, the agreement spared O'Brien from facing obstruction of justice charges. President Bush told a business group in New Jersey today that tax cuts passed earlier this year will help the economy by stimulating more investment. NPR's Don Gagne reports from the White House.
The president stopped in New Jersey on his way back to Washington from a weekend spent with his parents in Kennebunkport, Maine. It was another chance for the president to talk about the economy, which is still sluggish, but which he predicts will be helped by the latest round of tax cuts. The president has another speech on the same topic scheduled for later in the week in Minneapolis. The state of the economy could be a determining factor in next year's presidential election, and the president has a number of appearances planned this week with an eye toward 2004. Now a declared candidate, he will headline a Washington fundraiser for his reelection on Tuesday. Then on Friday, he travels to Greensboro, Georgia for another money-raising event. These are the first in a succession of fundraisers the president will attend in the next 2 weeks. Don Gagne, NPR News, the White House.
Illinois senior citizens could be paying less for prescription drugs under a new measure signed into law today. Tony Sarabia has details from Chicago Public Radio.
Illinois Governor Rob Blagojevich campaigned on lowering drug costs for seniors. Beginning January 1st, Blagojevich says they'll be able to sign up for the state's new prescription drug buying club.
By leveraging the buying power of our senior citizens and our state, we can negotiate better deals with pharmacies and drug companies and help our senior citizens save literally hundreds of dollars each and every year.
Under the measure, seniors will pay $25 a year to join the club in return for any discounts. The measure also centralizes the state's drug purchases, pooling the purchasing power of the state's nine agencies that buy prescription drugs. For NPR News, I'm Tony Sarabia in Chicago.
Stock prices closed higher today on Wall Street. The Dow gained 201 points, or 2.2%, to close at 9,318 in active trading. The Nasdaq gained 40 points, or 2.5%. It closed at 1,667. This is NPR News. Police in Texas say they've arrested a woman suspected of leading an immigrant smuggling ring that was involved in the deaths of 19 illegal immigrants last month. Carla Chavez, a native of Honduras, is one of 14 people suspected in the deaths of the immigrants who were packed into an overcrowded, unventilated truck trailer. Actor Hume Cronin has died from prostate cancer. A family spokesman said Cronin died yesterday at his home in Connecticut. He was 91. NPR's Ari Shapiro reports.
Today, many remember Hume Cronin for his roles as an old man in movies like Cocoon and Batteries Not Included. But Alfred Hitchcock was the first to cast Cronin in a movie, in the 1943 thriller Shadow of a Doubt.
He was running away from the police, and they were just about to nab him at the airport, and he ran plunk right into the propeller of an airplane.
One of Cronin's greatest strengths was his ability to become anyone. He didn't have a type. And actress Marion Seldes says that whatever the role, Cronin's transformation was always effortless.
He always seemed, sounds so childish, he seemed to be the person. And that, of course, is the art of acting.
Cronin was married to the actress Jessica Tandy for over 50 years. The couple won a special Tony for Lifetime Achievement in 1994. Ari Shapiro, NPR News, Washington.
The Supreme Court issued a ruling today that will make it harder for the government to force mentally ill defendants to take antipsychotic medication so they can stand trial. The 6-3 ruling applies only to nonviolent defendants. It says that the government will have to show that forcing defendants to take medication will significantly further the goal of bringing cases to trial. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, maker of cholesterol-free vegetable oil, ADM, the nature of what's to come, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is the comic Colin Quinn. He first became known for anchoring Weekend Update on Saturday Night Live. Now he's commenting on the headlines in his Comedy Central program, Tough Crowd with Colin Quinn. On each edition, Quinn leads a conversation with four other comics about the issues of the day. It's broadcast Monday through Thursday at 11:30, right after the satirical newscast The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. Quinn started his TV career in 1987 as co-host of the MTV game show Remote Control. He joined Saturday Night Live in 1995 as a writer and performer and stayed on the show for 6 seasons. Quinn anchored Weekend Update for 2.5 seasons. He was featured in the Jerry Seinfeld documentary Comedian and was a judge last week on the new show Last Comic Standing, which is the American Idol of the comedy world. Here's a clip from Tough Crowd. Quinn is talking with comics Dave Chappelle, Judy Gold, Nick DiPaolo, and Greg Fitzsimmons about mandatory school uniforms.
But even when you wore regular clothes, kids would make fun of you in school. They'd step on your sneakers the first day. Every morning, it was torture for me. You know, coming out and it's like, oh, your hair looks stupid, your clothes are dirty and wrinkled. I go, come on, Mom, I gotta go to class. I'll tell you something else.
So what even happened in your house? This wasn't even at school?
It wasn't even there.
Oh, my God.
That's hilarious. Well, a lot of great people wore the same. Einstein wore the same clothes every day. Charlie Brown, there's a lot of people. The same gear every day, man. You can't. That's why you wonder why everyone's got all these shallow-ass kids, because they gotta go to school and compete with clothes. Yeah. But now, granted, my kid is 2 and is rocking some Jordans right now. Yeah. But that's because I'm in show business. He got to look good so I can look good. Yeah.
You don't want a kid to drag you down.
Yeah. I want to mess my image
personally
up. I got to keep him thugged out, Nick.
Personally,
I'm a Jew, and uniforms scare me.
Well, I think
Thanks. She's a Jew. She can say that.
Well, your new show, Tough Crowd, features you and 4 comics, different comics, each day, talking about the news.
Right.
Now, what's the point of having comics sitting around talking about the news? What can they say that you think no one else will?
Well, first of all, I think that the comics can say things. First of all, they will say things. It's not that they have the intelligence to say things no one else will, but they do have that instinct to be more honest about, you know, without being politically correct about everything racial. And, you know what I mean? That's really the thing. I mean, to me, the big censorship thing has been race in the past 10 years. And everything else is open game. But I also think when the comedians are on a show, there's also that sense of reality in that no one's going to change anyone's opinion. You know, no matter how intelligent somebody is. Look at the Middle East. It's just all these brilliant minds trying to work this out and nobody changes. So it's like, at least at some point in the discussion, you realize the comedians are sort of acknowledging that by just giving up and turning on somebody just personally. So it kind of reminds me more of like the reality of life, which is that you give your opinion, somebody else gives theirs. You know, you try to get your point across. Nobody really wants to change their opinion. On some level, they already have it. And then you just start attacking each other and you leave on a kind of friendly note, you know, of like, you know, the world just goes on kind of thing.
Are there certain perils involved with bringing comics together and having them talk? Because, I mean, they can start picking on each other. They can start picking on you.
That's what they do. Yeah. I can't believe it. They pick on me all the time, and they pick on each other, and I pick on them. I mean, but that's good. You know, it's like, you know, I mean, that's part of the show, too. Instead of it just being like people just respectfully listening to each other's dumb opinions, kind of saying, okay, idiot, you know. Like, my favorite times is when people like call each other on trying to get an applause break from the audience by saying something that's so correct, not necessarily politically correct, just one of those statements like, well, I think people should care more about children, or I think war is bad, you know, or I think all human life is precious. Then we just start attacking them for trying to get the audience to applaud on, you know, with some vague statement that nobody's really going to disagree with.
Well, the other thing is that so many comics seem to be kind of, well, very competitive with each other, maybe a little antisocial. So here you are bringing them together in a little group.
they're the only people that can stand each other, though. I mean, I was at this roast last night for the Patrice O'Neill, one of the guys from the show.
Uh-huh.
It was the meanest thing I've ever seen, and I was involved in it, too, but, I mean, it was brutal. They really are. There's something very wrong with comedians. I'm starting to realize it more and more. I never believed it. I just was always like, oh, people just want to talk about projection. I felt like everyone projected their anger that comedians, you know, kind of bring out, you know, their anger that comedians are the catharsis for. So I used to think it was everybody projecting, but now I realize comedians are very damaged. In fact, I don't think I'm going to go to the show today, thanks to you bringing that up.
Glad to be of help. Let me play an excerpt of one of your opening monologues.
Okay.
And this was during the war in Iraq. Here we go. This is Colin Quinn from Tough Crowd.
Yesterday, if you saw the footage of, we blew up an Iraqi tank under a bridge without damaging the bridge. You know, so people can say whatever they want about our army, but thoughtful and considerate would certainly be two of the words you'd have to use. Okay, pretty soon we're not going to drop leaflets. We're going to start dropping comment cards. How was the war? How did you hear about us? Would you say you're a country that goes to war rarely? Sometimes? Frequently? Always? Would you recommend us to another unfriendly regime?
I thought that was very funny. So listening to that, you know, I'm thinking, how do you read the newspapers every day? Like, what do you take notes when you read the newspapers?
Sort of, yeah. I mean, I sort of do. It's like, for instance, even in that bit is a perfect example of you trying to find out what else is, you know, as ghoulish as it is, what else is funny about the war, which is that our desire to please people by sending comment card type stuff. Like our desire to, you know, our instinct to say, okay, you know, make us, you know, love us, you know what I mean? So it's like, yeah, you're always looking for that thing, you know? The other motivations behind things besides what the original joke, whatever everybody's saying is, you know?
Did you support the war?
Yeah.
Do you have any second thoughts about the war now that it's over, now that there are allegations that the weapons of mass destruction were, you know, nearly as plentiful in Iraq as we were led to believe, and allegations that the Bush administration might have tried to get intelligence agents to give selective information that would support the war in Iraq?
Well, of course. Just because I support it, it doesn't mean I'll be proven right or wrong in the next few years. But it's like, you know, I talked to some people from Afghanistan, some Afghanistanians, or Afghanis, as they like to be called. I like to call them Afghanistanians. I don't know why, because I'm from the 4th century when they were called Afghanistanians. And I was talking to some Mongols. No, I was talking to a horde of friends from Afghanistan, and they were saying, I said, how is Afghanistan? These people are very anti-Bush and anti, you know, very radical. And I said, how is Afghanistan, honestly, a year later? And they said it's 100 times better. And then they attacked, you know, other parts of it. But they had to admit it was better. So I'm saying, you know, I just feel like we're the lesser of two evils in a lot of these situations. And yeah, you know, no one's going to deny all the possible motives and the lack of purity in the motives. But ultimately, it seems like everything comes down to the lesser of two evils to me. And so I felt like in Iraq, we were probably the lesser of two evils in the long run. But, you know, that remains to be seen, I know. But I don't know. It's a tough call. And, yes, the weapons of mass destruction definitely is an interesting one to see where they are.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Colin Quinn, and he's now hosting the Comedy Central show called Tough Crowd, in which a small group of comics get together each night and talk about the news. Most of the comics on Tough Crowd are kind of like young, hip comics, you know, people like Dave Chappelle and Dennis Leary and comics who aren't as well known as they are.
Right.
But you also had on Pat Cooper, who's from a completely different era.
Oh, yeah.
He's kind of like an insult comic who would be playing, I don't know, Atlantic City or Vegas,
right,
or at least he would have been years ago.
Yeah.
And that show struck me as so bizarre, putting these two kind of generations, two completely different styles of comedy together. Would you talk about what that experience was like for you?
Well, I mean, it's just like, you know, I mean, he's just like I think among comedians, like everybody loves Pat Cooper type people. Like everybody loves the old comedians that are funny. You know, so it's like when you, so it's sort of our kind of way of like saying, hey, listen, we know what funny is, you know, and obviously everyone's political opinions aside, it doesn't matter what to us. I mean, for our little quality control of business, a lot of pretenders and a lot of people getting up trying to, you know, in that generation and in this generation and in the middle generations and I'm sure coming up, people that are trying to, under the guise of comedy, you know, they've got a million, they've got a million things like, you know, what do you call it, like bread and circuses or bright lights and loud noises, and they're not funny. So a guy like him, as miserable and mean as he is, and he's mean off stage to me too,
really?
He's really funny. Like he came on the show the first day. I can't even describe what's funny necessarily sometimes, but like here's what he does the first day. He comes on the show, and we had a couple of phone calls. You know, we're doing the show. It's a new show to us, so we're like, okay, make sure you call him, get this. He comes on, walks in the dressing room with all these young people, all these young comics and stuff, and goes, hey, hey, is this the Godfather? You gotta fax me three times this nonsense? What's my favorite political party? What color do I like? He starts ripping up his stuff, and he's really mad. But it was so funny, because he was right. It's like, we're making a big production. He goes, you think you're right, you're a cable show. You're acting like you're the Godfather. You're acting like I forget what other movie he said. He goes, I work with De Niro. You think I want to sit all day thinking about what's my favorite political? So he just started ripping into me, and everybody was crying because he meant it, but it was still, he was being funny, but he really did mean it. Just cutting past all level of nonsense that we thought, you know, hey, make sure he gets this, you know, like the modern day of, he's from the old school, you show up and you be funny. And here we are sending him faxes, asking him questions about, you know, who did he vote for? What does he think about the war? What does he think about this, you know?
And there's one point on the show where he's basically saying to you, oh, you're going to be washed up soon. There's younger comics. They'll be taking your place.
Yeah.
Oh, and then there's
it's funny because it's true.
and then in the middle of the show, he says, hurry up already. I have to take a pill.
Yeah.
This really slayed me.
Yeah,
I don't know.
It's so funny because it's so true. He does have to take a pill. And like and I think people identify with like, hey, listen, whatever you're talking about, at some point it just becomes, you know, I don't think he can curse on the show, but I mean, you know what I mean? And he's like, ultimately, if I don't take a pill, I'm going to die. So whatever nonsense is going on in the world, I personally am about to die if I don't take my pill. So let's get to it. So it's like that humanistic thing, you know?
There was one point where I thought you looked like you were really trying hard not to laugh. It's everybody's job to be funny, and you should be laughing. But there's one point where I thought that you thought your laughter would be so inappropriate that you were trying not to laugh. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, it's not that it's inappropriate. I'm afraid of Pat. I've seen him go off. We did this thing about a year ago with this short film. This guy Ray Garvey did in Pips, you know. So Ray Garvey goes to me, you know, he runs Pips, does comedy, you know, and he goes, hey, listen, you know, can you do this thing with me? Woody Allen's going to be there. So I'm like, yeah, Ray, I'll be there, but Woody Allen's not going to be there. Cut to 3 months later, Woody Allen bringing me on stage at Pips. So Woody Allen was there. It's like the first live appearance. It was crazy. Pat Cooper's on it too. You know, it's a bunch of like, you know, I don't know how all these ragtag different sides of everything got together, but Pat Cooper goes on. He walks in, and they're filming, and Woody Allen and these other people like Danny Aiello are there, so they're filming them laughing at Pat Cooper. Pat comes in and ad-libs 10 minutes. It's brilliant. Then they go, all right, Pat, now we got to do it again, and we shoot you this time. What? Well, we shot the Woody, and then they got to leave. What? You want me to? Yeah, could you do that again? Yeah, you want me to ad-lib what I just did again? Yeah, sure. You want me to kind of spontaneous? You know what? This thing stinks. He starts screaming, and he was dead serious. Next thing you know, we're out on Emmons Avenue in Brooklyn. Everybody's watching, and they're like, Pat Cooper. And the whole, it seems like the whole country's in on the joke that he goes off, and he starts screaming at me. He screams at Jackie Martin and goes, hey, come on, Pat, it's for friends. Friends? What friends? Jackie, you know how long I've been in this business? Friends, my ass. And he starts like, you know, giving all those Italian, like, and then I try to kiss Pat's ass because now I'm scared. I'm like, hey, Pat, at least you were funny, though. You were really great. You know, I'm trying to go the other way since I see Jackie's way is, you know, not working for him. I figure I'll grovel to Pat. That's not the point, Colin. That funny. Yeah, I'm funny. You start screaming at me. So, you know, part of that not laughing is not professionalism. It's just, you know, fear of Pat. he's a wrecking ball.
Well, here's Colin Quinn and Pat Cooper on Tough Crowd fielding questions from college graduates about their futures.
What's more important, happiness or money?
Money! Forget happiness. Happiness is when you die. Money is when you're living. Spend, grab, run, do whatever you got. Forget school, quit, go to Europe, hide.
Well, you know, Pat, it's kind of funny you bring that up because I was going to talk to you about, you know, you've been in the business about, you know, I mean, I make good money at the job, but sometimes I don't feel like it's as fulfilling as it...
No, it's fulfilling. Listen to me. The name of the game is surviving. You got a few dollars in your pocket, you're doing good. If you're broke, nobody gives a damn. I tell these kids, I tell my grandkids, don't go to school. That's what I'm going to do. Do what everybody does. Loaf.
But I'm talking about the existential crisis kind of thing, you know?
What is that word? I never heard of that word. See, I'm not educated. What does existential mean? What the hell does that mean? I don't understand. Where are you from Hell's Kitchen, and you're throwing in those big words? I got trouble with the. How does it matter? Because he's telling me.
Colin Quinn will be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is comic Colin Quinn. His show Tough Crowd is on Comedy Central. On your show on Tough Crowd, how do you know what you need to kind of bleep, or you know, how do you use bleeping or you know editing?
Well, I mean, I don't get involved in the editing or anything, you know, or bleeping, because it's like you know, there's not enough time for you to be around everything, you know. But I mean,
do people walk onto the show knowing what words aren't going to get on if they use them?
Well, I mean. The you know obviously are you talking about curses or other things? Because curses, you know, I don't even think I think that's my other big theory. If you'd like to hear, since I'm you know this is my national public radio thing, Terry. It's my one shot to give my theory.
Yes, and that's why we invited you on, because we were hoping you'd have a theory.
I do have a theory. Thank you, and it's fallen on deaf ears many times, but I think this is the one place people might actually be able to pick this one up.
Let's hear
Fake shock. Fake shock. Here's my theory. Ready?
Yeah.
He's going to be boring. You're going to cut this out of the show probably because it's too boring, but still, I'll make it quick.
Okay.
I talk very fast. My theory is that in the last 10 years, people need to feel like they're watching edgy comedy and the audience and the comedians and everybody is in collusion in this unconscious agreement where they'll say, okay, look, we really don't want to laugh at any truths. Uncomfortable truths about race or anything really, you know, important. So instead, we'll all agree that if you make like jokes about disabled people, that's shock. Or if you make jokes about midgets or whatever, that's cutting edge.
Okay, so you think that's all a substitute for race?
No, and I think that cursing is the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
I think that every time somebody talks about cursing on TV, I want to fall asleep. Where they're like, yeah, man, I want to say. You know, they cut us out from saying this, or they cut us out from making an AIDS joke. And it's all fine. I mean, I can carry the way about those kinds of things. I mean, maybe there is a legitimate reason those jokes can be made, but I do feel like it's substitutes for things that people really, really want to make the new things you shouldn't talk about.
Okay, well, let's talk about how you get to race on the show. Maybe you could describe what you did with Dave Chappelle.
I'm not going to talk about race, please. No, well, like the Chappelle thing was just... We just said five things that the other race always wanted to say to their race, I think it was. Something like that.
Do you remember what any
so
of them
like,
were?
I made him say five things I always wanted to hear a black guy admit. And he gave me five things he always wanted to hear a white guy admit.
So what did you give him?
You're right. I'm sitting here like, I guess you would like an example of that to keep the humor going. Good point, Terry. All right. I gave him like the fact that the biggest... The epitome of hypocrisy is that Trent Lott had to apologize for insinuating pro-segregation remarks on a station called Black Entertainment Television, which in its very name is promoting segregation. Nothing for that one?
Well, I think they're different, but...
Come on, but it's still funny.
Okay.
Don't you think... But it's called Black Entertainment Television. I admit, yes, if you look in the, of course you say, well, Trent Lott has a lot more power, blah, blah, blah. But still, you have to admit there's something kind of ironic about that. No? All right, fine. What were my other ones? Oh, I can't remember.
Oh, I think you gave him
that
one
that was
saying,
my big one.
I think you gave him one saying, not every white person I've ever met is racist.
No. What I gave him one saying was every white person I've met is not racist. No one has ever called me the N-word and something like that. That's what I gave him one saying, that every white person he's met is not racist and that every white person has treated him with kid gloves and has tried to welcome him. And, you know, just the delusion that it's 1960 in Selma all over this country kind of annoys me.
What did he give you?
Oh, thank God I got a laugh out of you. The first one bombed.
What did he give
but
you?
But even the I was about to try to sell not, you on my Trent Lott joke, but I'm just going to give up. Like we said on the show, you know, nobody ever changed their opinion. What did he give me? He gave me, I apologize for slavery. I apologize for the Jim Crow laws. And finally, at the end, it was like, I apologize for the whole Kenny G thing.
So have race relations moved forward as a result of this?
I think that, you know, when I grew up, I grew up in Brooklyn, and it was a very mixed neighborhood, and people really did. That's one of the reasons that I wanted that I'm so happy doing Tough Crowd, is because when I grew up, everybody was mixed all the time, and everybody would slam each other's races, but based on true things. Like, I was on the other night, and they're talking about black people shoplifting, whatever, you know, and being outraged about it. And I was like, don't pretend that 70 of your kids from, like, you know, Antoine Fisher High don't bum rush a Korean deli once in a while. I mean, these are facts that I've seen. So it's like, and they laugh because they know I'm not saying that they're genetically criminal. You know what I mean? I'm just saying these are things that exist. Just like they say white corporate things. I admit that too. You know what I mean? Like, last night we're talking about the Bush's awful tax cut idea, you know? And it's like when I grew up, everybody used to just say whatever they wanted about Puerto Rican, black, white, you know, Asian. And, you know, some people would say things that was dumb, cliche, stereotype. And some people would say things that really are accurate based on accurate things. So I think it's more I think if you're specific and it's true, I think that's fine. I think if people just make these, you know, like, it's like anything else, it's a judgment call. It's really a matter of, you know, the fine line, you know. And I feel confident about this kind of stuff because, you know, for the last 18 years, anytime I perform in front of clubs, it's always mixed. It's always black, white, Puerto Rican, Dominican, Chinese, and Indian, you know, everybody who lives in the country now. And I would know, especially with black people, I'm sure they'd let me know if they thought I was being, you know, I mean, the things I'm saying are true things, and some of them are unflattering to each different group of people. But, you know, if it's the truth, they laugh.
Colin Quinn, he'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Toms of Maine, maker of natural care products and creator of the Rivers Awareness Program to preserve the nation's waterways. Information at participating stores or tomsofmaine.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more with comedian Colin Quinn, and film critic David Edelstein reviews the new movie Manito. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with comic Colin Quinn. He's a former anchor of Weekend Update on Saturday Night Live. Now he has his own show on Comedy Central called Tough Crowd, in which he leads a conversation with four comics on the issues of the day. It's on Monday through Thursday at 11:30 p.m. after the satirical newscast The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. When we left off, Quinn was talking about his politically incorrect ethnic humor. Here's a good example from one of his Weekend Update newscasts on Saturday Night Live.
The House passed a bill this week that paves the way for Puerto Rico to become the 51st state. The flag will be displayed on a clothesline outside City Hall. Come on. Oh, that was wrong. But when I make the Irish jokes, everybody's fine. All right. That was wrong. Let me just finish. That part was actually just a joke. But seriously, the inaugural barbecue will be held on the shoulder of the West Side Highway this Sunday afternoon.
So, Colin Quinn, what reaction did you get to that?
First of all, I did not say that. I don't know who that is. I think that's Norm. No. I said that. The reaction I got was a lot of Puerto Ricans came up to me in the street and go, that was hilarious. You know, like, because, like I said, when I grew up, you know, in the 70s, people would laugh if it was realistic stuff. So the truth of the matter is, Puerto Ricans, a lot of Latin people, pull over to the shoulder of major throughways and barbecue there. And, you know, it's nothing against them, you know. Why is that a bad thing? But it's a fact, you know. So if I drive by and go, you know what? That's degrading to people. No, it's not, because I don't mean it to be degrading, and I think it shows how you mean it. If I thought, oh, they're disgusting, you know what I mean? That would be different. But, I mean, you know, people point out flaws. It's kind of an unwritten rule for the past 15 years, and I understand where it's based from and where it comes from, you know, but, I mean, in the last 15 years, the only people, again, my substitute shock theory, which really did not send shockwaves around the studio. I know it put everybody to sleep, but look, my substitute shock theory is that in the last 15 years, everybody wants to try to be like, hey, man, we're going to go after the Christian right and white guys and white. That's fine. I agree with that. But don't pretend that other people are flawless. If you really believe people are really equal, you know, internally, and you really believe in that, you know, common humanity, then you have to figure there's going to be the same amount of hypocrisy and, you know, whatever, you know, in each group, depending on their circumstances.
Well, you know, even in that clip that we just heard, like, you make that joke about the flag, and then you say, oh, that was wrong.
Well, exactly.
You're playing with that.
I'm playing with the idea. And I also said in that clip, oh, but I make the Irish joke, and it's fine, because I had made an Irish joke three jokes before where Irish were drunks, and everybody just went crazy. Like, you know, like, oh, so it was almost like ethnic humor. Yes, thank God you can make a joke that we'll laugh at that's kind of ethnic and kind of based on truth. Irish, you know, it's not like Irish people don't drink a lot. You know, it's part of the culture, you know, and it's not the most flattering or unflattering thing, but to not be able to sit there and go, you know, some Irish people drink a lot and some Jewish people drink a lot. Well, guess what? More Irish people drink a lot. And you know, when you can't speak about what you see in front of you, you can't be a comedian, you know?
Well, you know, I think a lot of Jewish people and a lot of African-American people feel like it's one thing for a Jewish person to make a Jewish joke or an African-American person to make an African-American joke. But for a white person to make a black joke or an Irish person to make a Jewish, that's no good. So, where do you stand on that?
It goes so much deeper than race. But, yeah, I mean, the bottom line is if I see anything happening and I can't say it because it's wrong, then how can I call myself a comedian? If it's a thing that I see as a truth, you
mm-hmm.
know,
mm-hmm.
how can I call myself a comedian? Then I'm just going to say, well, you know, that really is now is not the time for that kind of thing. Let me make up something about a group, or let me substitute a group. I mean, for years I'm watching comedians on stage going, you know, we got to go after the French. And part of it, this is before the war, because the French are rude, the French are this. Well, guess what? There's plenty of groups, and if you ever want to come see my act live, I'll talk to you about that are rude in their own different ways, everybody. And I talk about their specific rudeness, and they all live here. I don't have to go after the French, because I don't, you know, you see five French tourists. But it's that, what my famous substitute shock theory, which even now I'm starting to get into, to be honest with you. I'm getting more confidence in the substitute shock theory. It needs a new name. But other than that, so it's like, I do feel like, you know, the day that comes when I feel like, oh, well, I'm not going to talk about that, even though I've seen it 50 times, because that might be construed as racist or sexist or, you know, it's never going to come. I'd rather be killed, you know. That's what comedians are supposed to do, say what they think is the truth, only make it funny.
Colin Quinn is my guest, and he's now hosting Tough Crowd, which is a show on Comedy Central, weeknights at 11:30, in which a group of about four comics sit around and talk with Colin Quinn about the political issues of the moment. Now, Colin Quinn, getting back to your theory of substitution, what's it called?
Substitute shock?
Substitute shock, yeah.
This is a dream come true. Did you just say that? Back to my theory?
Yes.
All right,
yes,
go ahead.
Yes, I think it's an interesting theory.
Oh, this is exciting.
Your theory's working here.
You're the first person that, it's ever worked for. Thank you.
Okay, so since you have this whole theory that that comics use a lot of other things to make jokes about because they can't get to the central issue, which is race.
Right.
What was the issue of race when you were growing up? What was the ethnic makeup of your neighborhood, your school? You know,
I grew up in Park Slope, which was very ethnically mixed, which, as you know now, is a Swiss village. If you go back there today, it's just little blonde children running around. But at the time, it was very mixed. It was very black, white, Puerto Rican, and Asian and stuff. So it was really a mixed area, you know. And everybody had their problems, but it was just, you know, it just felt more like natural that, you know. And I do think it helps, you know, as far as in the long run to live in mixed neighborhoods. If you can legitimately say, hey, you know, these guys do this. It doesn't help to live in an integrated environment if you can't point out people's, you know what I mean? Because here's my favorite awful tagline that I always use. I feel like we live in a society where you can celebrate diversity as long as you don't point out that people are different.
Yeah, right.
And so that's the contradiction I feel sometimes. Like, hey, only celebrate it with some stupid parade where everybody goes up and shows a side of their culture that nobody does except that once that year, you know? So I feel like to really celebrate diversity, you can point out that, you know, well, like I used to do this joke in my act about black dudes. I'd say in the summer, I'd say to the audience, you know, there's always a lot of black guys in the crowd. I go, you guys got to realize something this summer. If you see a pretty girl, don't be shy. Just say something to her. Even if it seems like it's absurd or inappropriate, you got to take a chance if you want to meet girls. And so, you know, they everybody laughs because, you know, it's obviously not there, you know, and that's not a character flaw. It's just a fact what I've seen in my whole life. So it's like, hey, you know, I mean, there's something good about it too, but they'll come out and just say the thing. But either way, you know, it's like, I can't pretend that that's not a distinction between whites and blacks. And why would I, you know? And blacks certainly have no problem pointing that out, and they shouldn't. Their distinctions, you know, like Chris Rock or anybody, they'll say whatever they want, you know, and it's fine. They should. But, you know, it's got to be a two-way street or it's really going to be phony and it's just going to, it's not good, you know?
So were
and it
you,
also feeds, yeah.
Were your friends as ethnically mixed as the neighborhood itself?
No, I would never go near any. My mother told me, don't. No, I'm kidding. Yeah, they were. They were very. Yeah. I mean, my whole, you know, I had friends, some of the greatest names of all time, by the way. D'Artagnan Cortez. How about that for a name? Mm-hmm. Spanish kid. Mm-hmm. D'Artagnan Cortez. What a beautiful name, right? He was about 6'4". He called himself the world's largest Puerto Rican. Yeah. And Cleveland Carr, black dude, you know. They had some great names back in those days. My block was very mixed. I had it was almost like a feudal. It reminded me of Afghanistan. We had the Italians in the middle of the block, and they ran their little, you know, their little turf. Then you had the black family in one corner that ran their whole turf. They had, like, you know, their whole crew was down there. Then the Puerto Rican building on the corner across the street from them. And it was just like this whole mixed thing. And I was, this blonde-haired kid who luckily had a good sense of humor because it was very mixed, my neighborhood. And everybody, it's not to say that there weren't constant clashes, of course there are, but it was a different, it was just reality. Like, people would laugh. If you said something that was true, people, and still that way. When I go to clubs, if I say something about Puerto Rican or black, I was talking about the parade the other day. There's a bunch of Puerto Ricans in the club, you know? I go, the Puerto Rican Day Parade, and they're like, oh, but they're kind of excited to hear what you have to say. They don't want you to say, yes, what a beautiful, this is not funny, what a beautiful celebration of the culture of Puerto Rican people, if only white people could get past their uptightness. You know what I mean? That's not funny. What I said was, it's the only place you could see a grandmother in a tube top. Because, and that's not a negative thing. Hey, if you're proud of your body at that age, that's, you know, but it's not negative or positive. It's just a fact, you know, made funny. So that kind of stuff's not, if that stuff is offensive, you might as well, you know, take me off the earth, because that stuff is just having fun and saying something that could be taken as a positive and negative, or just, you know, an observation. So it's like, you know, walking on eggshells is never funny. And celebrating anybody's culture, white or anybody else, is not funny. It's not supposed to be a tribute, you know what I mean?
So did you and your friends talk to each other this way when you were growing up?
Yes, except I don't think we used this language, celebrating. No, but yeah, of course, are you kidding me? I remember one, there used to be some funny guys too. Like one time, this was not a racial joke, but there was this kid in my class, Godfrey Baptiste, but he was not West Indian, he was black American. And this kid, Mark Williams, another black dude, we were just getting yelled at by the teacher. We're like in sixth grade, and it's like, you know, real quiet. We're all like, you know, they were fed up with us. It was like a serious thing. Everyone's dead quiet. He's at the end of school. He just runs in our door, opens the door to our class, and goes, "Hey, Godfrey, your father said leave the sneakers on the back steps of the school. He's got to go to work after this," and shut the door. I mean, that is just funny. And ran out. And I mean, the whole place cried. Because we were so, you know, we were in trouble for something else. I forget what. But can you imagine how funny that was?
My guest is comic Colin Quinn. He's now hosting the show Tough Crowd on Comedy Central. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Colin Quinn. His show on Comedy Central, Tough Crowd, features him leading discussions with four comics on the issues of the day. It's shown Monday through Thursday at 11:30 p.m. So who were you when you first started to do stand-up? Like, what was your onstage persona?
My onstage persona was kind of like, it's hard for me to say exactly what it was, but it was not, I'll tell you one thing, it wasn't funny. I used to bomb so much that the comedians are the only reason I stayed in the business. Here's what I used to do. Here's my persona. This will give you an idea of how commercially, savvy I was at the time. I tried to base my cadence in comedy, mm-hmm. I swear to God, on a combination of The Ginger Man by J.P. Dunleavy and Ulysses by James Joyce. And I'm not kidding. So I would be talking this run-on sentence on stage. Monosyllabic run-on sentence.
Not good.
Oh, the crowds hated my guts.
What would you talk about?
Nothing that deep, but just the way I was doing it would not let them know, okay, here's a place for you to laugh, here's a place for you to laugh. So it's not that the material was funny enough. The comedians thought I was hilarious, you know? But I left no room for the audience to get involved and to be like, say, okay, here's a place where you could laugh if you choose to at this thing. So it was just me and this long, rambling, run-on sentence, you know, and... I didn't show them where they could laugh at my material. They just had to go along, and once in a while they'd laugh and get into that horrible rhythm that I had, but usually it would just be like, you know, baffled people drinking and, you know, ground round and, you know, Demarest, New Jersey, like, hey, what is this, you know?
How did you diagnose the problem?
The sad thing is, I've been doing comedy 18 years. I think I diagnosed the problem 3 years ago. I'm not even kidding. Isn't that awful?
How did you get started working on Saturday Night Live?
Yeah, well, I mean, I had written on Living Color, you know. After MTV, I went into L.A., I wrote on Living Color. I went into L.A. to get my own show, so I wrote on Living Color. And and so then I was sitting there, and I was just doing stand-up, and my friend Fred Wolf, who was one of the heads of head writers at SNL, he goes, "Kyle, you should audition for SNL, you know, to be on." I was like, "Oh, Fred, you know, I'm getting old already, you know." So I went there to audition for SNL, and they could tell my writing was good, even though I bombed, because it was like, here's the crowd. They shipped in a bunch of 15-year-old kids to the improv in L.A. from a camp for a comedy night. It's not good for my act, you know what I mean?
Yes.
And they're interested in, like, you know, basic stuff, you know, sex or whatever. And so, you know, they're trying to be like Mr. Subtle. I was still in my Joycean phase, I believe. Or at least I was in the remnants of it. Uh-huh. I think it was more of a, you know, I don't know, a Yeatsian phase maybe, where I was trying to break them apart. Okay, I'm overselling it, but but anyway, so I bombed. But they knew my material was good, so they hired me as a writer. And then when I was there, this guy Fred Wolf and Lorne would just be like, "Oh, look how funny he's being at rehearsal. Hey, why don't you put something in? Put in a." So I started doing that lion thing on Update, where I'd go on as this lion, you know, this like a lion that's got a lot of problems with the Department of Health. And so I'd just be doing all this stuff like, "I'm sorry to bother you people." Yeah, but I was in a lion hat, a lion costume, you know. I'd be like, "I'm sorry to bother you people. I'm waiting for a check from, National Geographic. My cousins, and just all these problems that a lion would have if he moved over here right now."
Mm-hmm.
But that was what started me doing stuff on the show.
Now, you know that American Idol comedy spinoff. What's it called?
The one I just did, you mean? Last Comic Standing.
Last Comic Standing, yeah. So comics are competing to, like, you know, win the prize and get the show.
Right.
And so it's funny, like, in the one that I saw, all the comics who are interviewed before their act, they're talking about, "I know I'm going to succeed. If I'm just myself, I know I'm going to be great." And then they get on stage and their act is like about what a schmo they are, about how neurotic they are, about what a nerd they are. And it just doesn't add up, you know?
Yeah, well, it takes 10 years. I mean, in my opinion, it takes 10 years before you really know who you are on stage. Like when you said, "What was my persona when I started?" Exactly. You know what I mean? I had a persona, which was not just me. It was like, you know, me trying to be like this kind of, you know, free associated of, Irish kind of like, you know, tortured but funny. I don't know what I was trying to do, but I was definitely trying to do something along those lines, you know, like some kind of, you know, intellectual. I was very influenced by, you know, reading the James Joyce and reading, J.P. Dunleavy. And so it was like, that's what I wanted to be, that guy on stage. So it was a persona, whereas now I'm just myself with all. And then when you're yourself, everything you do, you're shocked to find it. Every little petty resentment you have, everybody else has, you know? So it's like, it doesn't have to be. You're right. I mean, when people work, that's the problem. It takes you 10 years to figure out you don't need an image. You just need to be yourself, you know, because nothing else is really going to translate anyway, ultimately. You know, it's all you've got. So it's like, hey, you know, you either accept. It takes 10 years in comedy to go, look, this is all there is, folks. Don't look around. You know, Robin Williams is not going to come running out. Christina Aguilera is not going to come out and start singing. This is what it is right here. Me. This is what you got. It may not be enough. You may have a point. This may be this may not be enough, but it's all that's here. And this is where I live, so there's nothing you can do unless you want to kill me. You know what I mean? So once you get there, I think you can really be funny. Because you're realizing, I'm not Superman. I'm funny. I know I'm funny. I've worked hard on my act so that people, so that the crowd can really enjoy it. Because it's, you know, it's intelligent. It's not stupid stuff. It's not, you know, just scurrilous or spurious, accusations. It's all stuff that I've thought out and really worked on. But, you know, if they want more than that, you know, there's nothing. They came to the wrong place. And when you realize that that's it, then I really think you can be funny because you're relaxed and you're saying, this is it, folks. This is all there is.
Well, one last question. What are the plans for your show, Tough Crowd?
My plans for the show, Tough Crowd, are just keep trying stuff, you know, just keep trying to mix it up a little bit and see what's really going on, you know. I mean, I look at this Israeli and Palestinian thing today and it's like, it's just so amazing to me. It's baffling to me that nobody really knows enough to at least get a good beat on it. Because you watch the news, it's been the same for 30 years. It's been the same my whole life, you know? And it just amazes you. And it's scary for everybody in the world because you say, if they can't solve this one, whatever gets solved, whatever gets forgiven, whatever gets solved. You know, even Northern Ireland's not really solved. Mm-hmm. And that was a no-brainer, as they say, in world politics. You know, I mean, that looked like an easy one. You know, it's so much smaller. It's so much. Everybody looks the same, you know, it's so, you know, confined. Clinton went over there. I assume we gave them a lot of money in, like, 1997. Remember when it was almost solved? Like, Clinton almost solved the Northern Irish?
Right, with George Mitchell, yeah.
And then, that's already, you know, they've already got their trouble. The thing's coming back a little bit, you know? So it's like, it's just depressing when you think of that. So Tough Crowd is going to have to solve all these problems.
Well, good luck.
Or else we're just going to, we'll either solve these problems or we'll insult each other's shirts until we die. Trying.
Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks, Terry.
Colin Quinn's program Tough Crowd is on Comedy Central Monday through Thursday at 11:30 p.m. Coming up, film critic David Edelstein reviews Menino. This is Fresh Air. Eric Eason's low-budget Latino drama Menino won prizes and acclaim at some of the world's most prestigious film festivals and has led to a Hollywood career for its star Frankie G. But it's taken more than a year to find theatrical distribution. It's now in theaters and on DVD as part of a new subscription series. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
The action in Menino is a little hard to see and the dialogue a little hard to hear, which is not surprising since it was shot on video by a first-time director named Eric Eason for about $25,000. The handheld cameras bob and weave and come in tight on the characters, and if you sit too near the screen, you might get seasick. It's hard to get a fix on the plot. The protagonist, who's called Junior, wakes up, interacts with his wife and kids in a groggy manner, drives around Manhattan's Washington Heights, then goes to his job as a painting contractor, while people in his family get ready to celebrate his kid brother's high school graduation. For a long time, you can't tell who's related to whom. And the actors look like they're making up the dialogue, which jumps back and forth between English and Spanish. And then, before you know it, Menino pulls you in. The movie is a mere 76 minutes, but it has an overflowing quality. The details are fresh and surprising, and people who are seen only casually stay with you. Around the two-thirds mark, the film takes a swerve into melodrama, or maybe it's grand opera, and it ends on a note of mythic horror that is sudden but that feels fully earned. This is the rare little movie that gets bigger as it goes along. It can hardly contain its own emotion. A lot of the power comes from the actor who plays Junior and calls himself Frankie G, short for Gonzalez. He's a guy with big muscles and a rough complexion. And since he made Menino 3 years ago, he's turned up in the Hollywood movies Confidence and The Italian Job, where he seemed like the Kmart Vin Diesel. You have to see Menino to know why directors were so hot to cast him. Frankie G isn't trained, and his diction is mush, but he's got presence here that better actors would kill for. He throws himself into his big emotional scenes, and his amateurishness works for him. It makes him seem more helpless. Halfway through the movie, we learn that Junior's dad was a cocaine dealer and that he used his son as a lookout. When Junior was caught and convicted, his dad barely flinched. He never even visited his son in prison. Since getting out, Junior has made an honest living, or semi-honest, since he's a hustler who lies like mad on the job, and he'll jump into bed with any Boca Chica who swishes by. But one thing has kept him grounded, his love for his kid brother Manny, his Menino, a slender little guy who's just been accepted at Syracuse University. Junior hasn't let their father anywhere near the boy. But when Manny gets in trouble with the cops, Junior discovers that in this kind of hothouse working-class environment, the sins of the father have a way of sticking to you like a sweaty T-shirt.
How long has your brother been a drug dealer?
I don't know what you're talking about, you know?
What was he doing with the gun?
He don't own no gun.
Whose gun was it? Your father's?
My father's.
Your father's a drug dealer, isn't he?
He was a drug dealer.
What about you?
What about me?
You still deal?
I'm a painting contractor.
I've heard complaints that Menino's loose dialogue and documentary style don't mesh with its florid and tragic finale. but I think it's all of a piece. Part of the brilliance of the early scenes is that they capture the push and pull of life in a community where everyone's on top of everyone else. Comfortably close, yet as it turns out, dangerously close for comfort. The movie won prizes at the Sundance and Tribeca film festivals, but it's a tough sell to multiplex crowds accustomed to more spit and polish. The company that's distributing it, Film Movement, is trying something new. They're giving Manito a limited run in big cities while at the same time marketing it as part of a subscription series on DVD. Film Movement is the brainchild of Larry Maestrich, who ran an outfit called The Shooting Gallery that went belly up a few years back. For a while, Maestrich did well distributing movies like Croupier and Judy Berlin. What did him in, he has said, was the prohibitive cost of marketing small movies. I don't know if the subscription model will work for DVD the way it does for repertory theaters and symphony orchestras, and watching films at home is obviously a poor substitute for the communal movie-going experience. But there are film lovers all over the country with no access to movies like Manito, or who can't afford to pay for big-city parking and babysitters. I'm for anything that makes small and challenging films accessible to everyone, everywhere, at the same time, that puts them where movies belong, in the present tense.
David Edelstein is film critic for the online magazine Slate. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with a recording featuring the trombonist Jimmy Nepper. He died Saturday of complications from Parkinson's disease. He was 75. Nepper was best known for his work with Charles Mingus. Here's Nepper on the 1961 Mingus recording, Eat That Chicken. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Bantam Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of The Elegant Gathering of White Snows, a novel about eight women whose impromptu walking quest touches a nation, by Chris Radish. This is NPR, National Public Radio. On the next Fresh Air, the ties between members of the Bush administration and the defense industry, and questions of conflict of interest regarding lucrative contracts to rebuild Iraq. We talk with Charles Lewis of the Center for Public Integrity and a spokesperson for the Army Corps of Engineers. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.